The following program is brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities. The opinions expressed by the members of CFCI and their guests should not be construed as specific investment, legal, or tax advice, and all economic and performance information is historical and not indicative of future results. Investing may involve the risk of loss of principal. Any tax advice on the show is not intended to be used by any person for the purpose of avoiding U.S. federal or state tax, and penalties may be imposed on such persons, and each listener should seek advice from their own tax advisor, legal counsel on topics that arise from the show. The representatives of CFCI and their guests are not providing legal or tax advice. Nothing should be construed as a solicitation to offer or buy securities. Now enjoy the show. Welcome to the big show, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes. Thanks so much for hanging out with us. It is graduation weekend, if you haven't noticed, around Bloomington. It took me a little longer than normal to get down Walnut Avenue up to the Walnut Street up to the station. So all of the families are in town. I need to reach out and say congratulations to my nephew Ray, who's graduating from the informatics school, and my cousin Holly, who is graduating from the School of Journalism. So we were, I think Ray's actually mowing my grass right now, so I need to find a new person to mow my grass. I have a 15-year-old, so he's growing up. He's just about ready to get on the zero term, but not quite yet, so going to miss Ray mowing my grass. But we were talking the other day, and I said, man, that was a fast 4 years. And he goes, yes, it is. I said, but here's the thing. The next four, it's going to go even faster, and then the next four, even faster and even faster. You guys all listening know exactly where I'm coming from. Hey, we're going to have a good show today. Rod Holloway will be joining me in just a little bit. It is the investment show, a lot going on. We're going to do a little news of the week. First brought to you by our upcoming town hall meeting. It's called Dealing with Dementia. It's this Wednesday, next Wednesday, May 11th. It's at the Bloomington Country Club at 5:30. And, you know, Kathleen Weber was on the show not long ago, and we're really trying to just have this discussion about dealing with dementia. A lot of families are dealing with it. You know, how do you start to identify a person that has dementia? What are some signs? When do you intervene? How do you intervene? How do you, you know, what to expect as things materialize? If it's a parent, if it's a grandparent, if it's a spouse, I mean, it should be a really nice, nice, nice meeting. As of right now, I think we have about a little less than 20 people coming, so it's going to be a very quaint event, an opportunity for you to share and to talk about things and ask questions. Kathleen Weber will be there with me as I sort of moderate the town hall meeting next Wednesday, May 11th, over at the Bloomington Country Club. Really like you to come. The way you register, really simple, cfci.us. That's our website. You've heard it a million times. On the right-hand side, there's a seminar button. If you click that, it should be able to pull up the page, and you can just register for the event. We're not going to feed you, but we'll have, you know, some cookies and things like that, coffee, tea, things like that. So it'll be fun. It'll be a good time. Very informative. Hope you can come. I was reading on Yahoo Finance how a shift in the Saudi oil thinking deepens the OPEC split. OPEC officials gathered this past week to formulate a long-term strategy in a room expected to discuss how oil prices can become more stable, and they ended up fighting over it. The Saudis have actually kind of had an about face here, and they're saying, okay, we don't think that trying to peg oil prices are going to work any longer because we have a major shift in the global markets, and it's more of a structural change and not a temporary trend. So the Saudi governor said he believed that the world has changed so much in the past few years and it's become a futile exercise to actually try to peg these prices and target prices. I mean, we've got demand weakening globally and supplies up. Kind of makes sense. Speaking of oil, the rout in crude prices is snowballing into one of the biggest avalanches in history of corporate America bankruptcies. 59 oil and gas companies now have filed bankruptcy after this past week's filing for creditor protection. Some of the oil producers are hanging on, hoping that the price of crude does stabilize at higher levels. In February, oil went down as low as $27 a barrel. Of course, it peaked well above 100 just about 2 years ago, but I saw just today it was around $44 a barrel. So if it can hang in there, $40 to $60, hopefully the bankruptcies will slow. And from Kiplinger, I found 10 financial decisions you will regret forever. Financial regrets, of course, we've all had a few in our lives, but there's a big difference between making an impulse purchase that you second guess the next morning after making a major decision about your money that could haunt you forever. They reached out, Kiplinger reached out to a dozen financial planners and personal finance experts for their views on some of the most consequential mistakes people can make with their money. One, borrowing from 401ks, claiming Social Security too early was two, paying just a minimum on your credit cards. Jim, you got to hear this one. Young people are notorious for doing that. Putting off savings for retirement. It's a big one. See it all the time. Bankrolling your kids. You got to say no sometimes. Passing up financial advice when you need it is a big one. Avoiding the stock market, another mistake people make. We see this a lot. Ryan and Wayne work with a lot of school teachers, government employees, and they have a fixed account that they can put their money in. And avoiding the market is one of the biggest mistakes that you can make over a long period of time. They stick it in there believing that's safe, but it is safe from the perspective of you're not going to have volatility, but you're never maybe going to have the returns you need to have the money you need down the road. I love this one. Number nine was buying into a timeshare. How many of you have done this? You know, and you can't get rid of them. So in fact, you try to give them away and people don't even want to take them sometimes. Now, some people use them. It all works out well. But I could tell you there's probably five to every one that wishes they would have never bought into that timeshare. And then number 10 was falling for too good to be true offers. We've all been sucked into those. Hey, we're going to take a break. When we come back, it is the investment show. You know, as of last Friday, the S&P 500 is on its second longest bull run in history. So the question is, with the volatility and changes on the horizon, can these bulls keep running? We'll be back to give you a little commentary on that. This is Your Money with David Hayes. From our commentary that we send out every 2 weeks, it's called our weekly update that we send out every 2 weeks, which we probably should change that to a biweekly update, but it's on our website, cfci.us. You can go to, I think it's called In Touch, but you can check this out. But we wrote about this as of last Friday, the S&P 500 on its second largest bull run in history, surpassing that famous, and I'm just joking, but famous 1949 to 1956 bull run. It lasted 2,607 days. The longest bull market in history actually ran from 87 to 2000, lasting nearly 4,500 days. But the question is, after months of volatility, which we experienced early in the year, and changes on the horizon that all of us can somewhat see, can the bulls keep running? Well, we came up with a few major points for people to consider. The number one point is bull markets don't die of old age. I mean, history shows us that bull markets end because of a variety of shocks like spikes in oil prices, recessions, bursting asset bubbles, geopolitical issues, extreme leveraging like we saw in 2008. While the past, of course, does not produce any kind of future results, we should evaluate threats to market performance instead of worrying about these birthdays that come up. Another thing is economic indicators are actually supporting growth. Recessions have accompanied most previous bear markets, and even though we recognize recession risk are higher this year than in most economists don't see an economic downturn in near future. Also, this is a big one. We have experienced some pretty healthy pullbacks. I mean, one of the makers of a bull market top is elevated investor optimism and unsustainable high stock valuations. And you've heard us talk about this on the show that, you know, when the market starts to go up, we get hope, we get some relief, we get into optimism, then excitement, thrill, euphoria. And then the market starts to go down, you get a little anxious, then you get into a denial mode, fear, desperation, panic, and then you get into despondency and capitulation. I mean, that's the investor emotional cycle. We have actually seen some pullbacks. Since the last S&P 500 market high back in May of 15, markets have retrenched a lot of times as investors have taken stock of these global risks to growth. We haven't seen the irrational exuberance that often overshadows a bear market term. Now, if you are in that bear camp where, hey, we think the market isn't going to continue to at least stay flat or go up, we recognize that. Threats to economic growth from China and Europe, they might prove to be too much for the markets. We don't know that we've seen the worst out of China. It's a hard landing, if it happens, of the second largest economy in the world. It'll send ripples through the global economy, no doubt about it. That could threaten markets. Europe is grappling with political, economic, and security issues that could threaten the EU. We have the UK considering getting out of the European zone, and we'll see if that has any real legs as the summer unfolds. The Federal Reserve, I mean, they may just absolutely bungle monetary policy. I mean, the Fed is performing a very, very delicate dance to bring interest rates closer to historic levels. Now, you raise rates too fast, the economy could stumble. You raise them too slowly, the Fed doesn't have anything left in their quiver to fight off another economic slowdown. So a monetary policy misstep could trigger a market downturn. Also, corporate profits. they might continue to fall. I mean, U.S. companies, they've been struggling to find growth. I mean, with challenges globally, obviously, we talk about that all the time. Earnings have declined year over year for the fifth quarter in a row. And that continued weakness, that could cause investors to become bearish about stocks, sure. So you, as you look at this thing, you can say, okay, yeah, I see that, and I also see this. But, you know, our view, the simple truth is, no one can predict market tops or bottoms. Plenty of people say they can, but it's a matter, really, of an educated guesswork pattern. That's really what it comes down to. Instead of trying to call the markets, what we do is take a look at overall domestic and international fundamentals. We try to create portfolio strategies that align with people's overall goals. We can assume that the current bull market will come to an end at some point, but keep this in mind. To reach that number one spot, all records are meant to be beat. Look at Golden State this year, beating the Chicago Bulls winning record. I mean, that was unbelievable. But to get that to that number one spot, the current bull run would have to continue through 2021, and that's a pretty big stretch. So rather than worry about when the end might come, just adjust those portfolio strategies as needed and prudently position your investments as your risk tolerance will allow. Hey, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about sell in May and go away. Is it a rhyme without a reason? Rod Holloway will be joining us shortly to talk about that. This is Your Money with David Hayes. You know, the rhyme without a reason, possibly. Sell in May, go away, come back again after Labor Day. We say this every single year. I've been on the radio. You hear it all the time from commentators in the financial markets. Rod Holloway joins me now on the phone. Rod, when we talk about these little sayings, I mean, sometimes they have some validity, but we've been talking about sell in May, go away, come back again some other day for many, many years. What would you tell people who think that they should seriously take all of their 401k money, slam it into the money market account, sit it out, drink beer, hang out all summer long, and then push it back in the fall?
Yeah, I would say it's probably not a wise way to manage your portfolio. And there are a few reasons for it. Number one, when you, and here's a quote in doing a little bit of research along this that I think says it best. It's by a J.C. O'Hara with FBN Securities. And what he said is, one is selling not to avoid losses, but rather selling because there is not much to gain. So that period in May till the fall isn't that it's a disastrous period that we've had massive sell-offs during that time horizon. You just haven't made a whole lot of money during that period. So to time the market to avoid going flat or only gaining 1 or 2%, and if you miss it by a week or 2 weeks or a couple of days, I know you've talked on the show about just missing the 10 best days mm-hmm. in the year and how big of an impact that has on your overall performance, where you wouldn't want to do it for that reason. A couple of other things. One, for the guy you just talked about, the 401k, it doesn't impact him, but say for somebody who's managing money that is outside of their retirement account, well, you're locking in a whole bunch of short-term capital gains, so you're paying a lot more in taxes on your gains if you do that plan, because you're never in your stocks for greater than 12 months and getting the lower, longer-term capital gains rate. So that, once again, for the non-qualified assets, wouldn't make sense. The last point in regards to that I have, I believe that it is less effective today than what it used to be. The reality is this began way back, and it's kind of evolved, but it really, the saying began, sell in May and go away, come back on St. Ledger's Day. Well, St. Ledger was one of the last major horse races in Europe, in London or Britain, to be specific, and it was at the end of September. And really, it derived from the fact that come May, most of the money managers began taking their summer vacations. So there really wasn't anyone around to do any trading. Volume was extremely light and flat. Well, in today's world in which we are so interconnected, everybody has the ability to trade and manage portfolios from a mobile device. So even when they're on vacation, while they don't want to spend as much time on it as because they're on vacation as they would normally during the other months, they still have the ability to. They have the ability to see what's going on in the market. You know, we're no longer trading off of paper tickets. We're trading electronically. It's all done via the internet. So it's so much easier to take on activity through the spring and summer months than what it used to be when this trend first began. But the biggest thing is, like I said, you're not avoiding major losses by getting out of the market in the summertime. You're really just avoiding a lackluster, robust market that goes flat to maybe only up 1% to 2%. So I don't see the reason to avoid it and potentially miss a couple of the best days with that time horizon when you're not really attempting to avoid major losses.
Pretty good Wall Street Journal article this week, but Rod, you're exactly right. I mean, you set yourself up for errors when you try to get really tactical like that. If the market doesn't fall and instead it rallies, you could make it tougher to find a re-entry point into stocks. But here's a point that they were making, Rod, in the Wall Street Journal. During the period between Memorial Day and Labor Day, daily stock trading volumes on the New York Stock Exchange tend to fall about 3.1% below yearly averages, to your point. According to that data that goes back to 1996, and that fewer shares trading hands means that swings in the market can be a little bit sharper. And then going back to 1970, the S&P 500 has actually gained 1%, as Rod pointed out, on average in the period between Memorial Day and Labor Day. And that's according to analysis from Credit Suisse. But stocks rose 30 of those summers by an average of 5.6%. The declines were a little more painful, averaging about 8%. But, Rod, you're exactly right. I mean, I think it's hard for someone to time that stuff, and I loved your saying just a few minutes ago. Hey, let's go back to what I was talking about from a market perspective. We were talking about, you know, this bull run, second longest in history. If we take that number one spot away, we have to move on to 2021 before we pass that 4,500-day mark. But when we talk about bull markets, I know, Rod, we also have to look back and say, hey, at the beginning of the year, we had a market that dropped 11% about. So were we still in a bull market? And I think that's where I want to explain to people, have you help explain to people, what really is a bull market and what really is a bear market?
Sure. Well, in the simplest of terms, from a bear market perspective, most people tab a bear market when you have retracted 20% from the most recent high. So that doesn't tell you anything other than you had a 20% sell-off. Now, how long does that sell-off have to last? That's some of the things that are unanswered. Nobody has a very common theme when it comes to that. The only commonality between people talking in bear markets is the 20%. Now, what we've talked a lot about from a bull market's perspective is a secular bull market. You already alluded to in the previous segment, the longest one we've had was a secular bull market from 87 to 2000. We believe we're in another secular bull market that began, obviously, when we came out of our recession from 2008, and that began in the bottom of the market in March of 2009. We believe we're still in a secular bull market. Within a secular bull market, you can have a flat to negative year. The biggest thing is that you're not interrupting the overall long-term trend, and that's where we're still at. So while we've had some corrections, matter of fact, on certain indices and most definitely on individual stocks, you've hit that so-called bear market 20% down from its last high. You have hit that, but that doesn't interrupt the overall trend of the market, which is still continuing to trend upward. So when you go back and you look from 2009 to now, yes, that upward trend has flattened out a little bit, but it hasn't rolled over. It hasn't started going down and broken that upward trend if you started drawing trend lines on the chart that you were looking at. It's still intact from the standpoint of a secular bull market. What you also said in the previous segment, nailed it right on the head. Bull markets don't end due to age. They typically end with a recession. And that recession can be brought on by many of things, as you alluded to, spikes in oil, bubbles, whether it be a tech bubble, a real estate bubble. We've only really had a few bear markets that weren't brought on by a recession. Right now, we don't see a recession on hand for the economy. Now, you did also allude to the fact we've had five consecutive quarters of decreasing earnings. Now, this can sometimes be a little bit confusing because some of our listeners probably go, now, wait a minute here. I keep hearing that 65 or 68% of companies beat estimates. Well, they beat estimates for that quarter. And that's the job of the CFO and the CEO to push down expectations so that they can come in and beat those expectations. What you're alluding to is a year-over-year comparison. So if we're looking at the first quarter this year compared to the first quarter of last year, and we have had some consecutive decreasing earnings. The reason we don't consider that to be overly alarming right now is we do believe the second half of the year we will begin to see a reversal in that trend. And heading into 2017, people feel very comfortable and have started ratcheting up some of those earnings numbers, that we will begin to see some growth there. And, of course, globally, most people are expecting some of the companies that have been kind of struggling, and they started their struggles after us, such as Europe, that they're finally going to start gaining a little bit of traction and begin their recovery phase. And, of course, we're such a global economy now anymore that if they begin to recover, it's going to have a bit of a spillover effect onto us and will help our earnings recover as well.
It's Rod Holloway. He is the equity portfolio manager over at our office, CFCI. And, of course, you can catch Rod every Monday morning at 7:20 on Glass in the Morning, and again on Friday to do the wrap-up as I give a little update on what's happening on the show on Wednesdays. So, Rod, we appreciate you taking the time as always, and I hope you have a terrific weekend. The weather sounds like it's going to be pretty good, and don't forget to get over to Hallmark and get a card for Mama. It is Mama's Day, Mama Day. So.
Oh, yeah, most certainly. I've got a wonderful daughter who's great at shopping, and she doesn't forget things like that, so she's already been asking, what are we getting Mom for Mother's Day? So I will let her take care of it, because not only does she remember those things, she's an excellent shopper, so I just give her the money and let her go to town.
And Hot Rod, you know, I have a son, Will, who's 15, same age as your daughter. And when I say to him, hey, this weekend's Mother's Day weekend, he'll say, what, it is? So that's the difference between boys and girls.
Hey, that's exactly right.
Rod, thanks a lot, man. I'll see you later.
Okay, have a great show, Dave.
All right, guys, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about gold. Our friend Rodney Johnson, the senior editor of Economy and Markets, put out a smoking good article this week, and he actually has done this in the past, and I've shared it with you over the many years on the show, how gold is not a currency. And gold has been on a tear this year. Precious metals up like almost 20%. That's great. For those of you holding gold, we should all be happy for that, right? And we should take our coins down to the grocery store and buy something, but you can't, because you got to have it in that cotton form, our noble currency, before you make your way to the checkout stand or down to the wonderful Malibu Grill or over to buy some furniture at Furniture Exchange. You have to have cash. So when we come back, I'm going to build the case for why gold is not money. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, every day, everywhere, everyone. It is live radio. Your Money with David Hayes. I'm getting so wrapped up in that summery sounding music. I was just kind of floating off into all of the wonderful things that we do during the summer. But hey, I wanted to mention Lemonade Day. It is coming up Saturday, May 21st, right here in Bloomington. It's still not too late to sign up if you have a young child that would like to build a lemonade stand. Create a product, create marketing, sell it, pay back investors. I mean, the idea is that they build a stand, spark a dream of entrepreneurship. Still not too late. You can go to bloomington.lemonadeday.org. But if you don't want to do any of that, just remember, on that Saturday, go around, support these kids, and buy some lemonade. It's a lot of fun. I can't wait for that. But when you go to buy lemonade, you're going to need to have dollars, right? Not gold. Because gold is not money. Our friend Rodney Johnson, who's been on the show many, many times, he does all the research for the Harry Dent Organization. He is the senior editor of Economy and Markets. He wrote a really good article this past week. And he talked about, you know, how gold is on a tear. I mean, the metal's up like 20%. I mean, and again, that's great. Those of us that have gold should be happy. But then we want to take those gold coins, right, down to the grocery store so we can buy, well, pretty much nothing, because the gold has to be converted into little pieces of cotton, which is our noble currency, of course, before making their way down to the checkout stand. I mean, that's what you have to do. So, but to be fair, I mean, some coins were actually money many, many, many years ago, like the $20 gold piece. In some states, it actually is even still legal to use these coins today as money. Now, if you did it, you need to have that something slapped upside your head, because you'd be giving away a lot of money. But for all practical purposes, gold is not money today. In fact, gold is not identified as money or currency in any major country. I mean, anything can be used as money. Seashells could be used as money. Acorns could be used as money. anything that could be divided in discrete units and that everyone agrees that has a value could act as money. Just because my doorknobs and coat hangers at home could be used as cash, doesn't make them cash, right? That's because the second part of the equation, the general agreement of a store value, is essential. I mean, if my neighbor Bob doesn't think my coat hangers are worth trading for goods and services, then I have a problem, right? But guess what? My coat hangers do have value. My wife would say that they don't have any value, as I have a tendency of taking my suit off and laying it over the bathtub for maybe 2 or 3 days in a row. And then she'll say on Thursday, will you please hang those suits up? And then I do. So my coat hangers, they actually have value, but even though they're not money. Now, if I have enough of them, and Lord knows I do, I could scrap them down, sell them off again for money, and then use that money to buy what I want. But the integral step of trading coat hangers for dollars is the real key. Just because the market value of the metal of my coat hangers goes up or down doesn't mean my coat hangers are now a substitute for cash. It simply means that the commodity value of what they're made value fluctuates. Welcome to the gold conversation. I mean, none of this means that gold is not valuable. I mean, the same countries that don't allow gold as a currency, including the U.S., do keep it in their vaults. So obviously they think there's some value there. You know, go figure. But the amount of the things you can buy with gold fluctuates dramatically, which reflects the true nature of the metal. So it's a commodity, not money. If gold were a currency, we would discuss it in terms of stable valuation, like a piece of eight, which is 1/8 of a gold coin. It could buy a good meal tonight. It could buy maybe a person to come out and work at your house for 8 or 10 hours. It could be about a half of a car payment. These values wouldn't change that much, if at all, over the course of a year. Gold would be the basic measure that we use to establish value for like everyday things in our life, food, water, shelter, labor, all of that. But we don't do that. Instead, gold is free to gyrate wildly up and down, right? Or maybe sometimes not at all. But we talk about this gyration movement in dollars, in the sense of dollars, which brings us to the other side of the conversation, our greenbacks. The value of the dollar changes over time, but usually very, very slowly. As we make payments for labor or our home or whatever, that doesn't change that quickly and can affect many things. It can be affected by many things like deficits and U.S. central bank actions, things like that. But if we collectively believe the value of the dollar is falling, then we'll demand more of them for payment of goods and services. I mean, that's just the way it goes. We'll also have to shell out more dollars to buy commodities like oil, copper. Since gold is a commodity, we'll have to pay more for that as well. But none of this changes the fact that gold is not money today. Instead, it's a commodity with very special properties. It's a concentrated piece of metal. It doesn't disintegrate. It doesn't rot. It doesn't go bad. It can be molded into any form, which I'm sure my wife would love something like that for Mother's Day. It exists in limited quantities. And, you know, these are some of the reasons why people around the world think gold has a lot of value. But beyond all the physical qualities, gold's most valuable quality is the fact that so many people put their faith in it, which is something that can't be fully explained. Why is this metal, which has very few uses beyond decoration, considered a standard value around the world and across thousands of years? I don't have the answer, folks. Otherwise, I'd tell you. And I don't think I ever will. So if that doesn't convince you that gold is not money, gold is a commodity, I don't know that I ever will. Hey, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to talk about the questions of the week. Boy, we have some good ones this week. We have, if I can find them here, we've got them. They're good. Trust me. Just come back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. After that last segment on money is not gold, I asked Jim, our producer, I said, Jim, did that make sense or was it a little bit too long? He's, no, I thought it made sense. You know, gold's not money. And I go, if you got that out of it, then you got it. So if you got it, you got it. Hey, I wanted to remind you once again that we are holding a town hall meeting next Wednesday. It's May 11th from 5:30 to approximately 7 o'clock. We'll see how long it goes on dealing with dementia. It should be really, really good. If you have someone... it could be anybody. I mean, you don't have to even have anything going on in your life as it relates to someone with dementia, but we're going to have Kathleen Weber there. She's going to be talking about how to identify someone who is dealing with this or maybe down the road of dementia, what things you can do to intervene if need be? How do you do it? What to expect when you have the unexpected. So it should be really good. And we have about 20 people or so signed up so far. It's just open to the public. Again, Dealing with Dementia Town Hall Meeting, Wednesday, 5:30 p.m., Bloomington Country Club. So here's how you register to come. We'd like to know how many people are going to be there for the setup. CFCI.us, that's CFCI.us. On the right-hand side, there's a seminar tab. And if you click that, it should pop right up. You can register. Of course, it's absolutely free. I mean, that's we don't have to say that, but yeah, it's free. Come, engage. It should be terrific. So we encourage everyone to come. All right, questions of the week. We've got a lot of them here, so we're going to start with this first one. I know that certain things open up for me at different ages as it relates to retirement. Could you spend a little time on this on your show to talk about these, quote, milestones, for lack of a better word? Thank you. I look forward to this week's show. You know, next week, Doug Hughes will be here in studio live, as I will be at the EdSlot Elite IRA Advisor Group meeting. I will be calling in, so we'll be talking a lot about some of these milestone ages. But, you know, basically, there's certain ages, like 50, 55, 59 and a half, 60, 62, 65, 66, and 70 and a half. Those are your big milestone ages. And 50 is big because that's the year you can start putting catch-up provision, catch-up money in IRAs and 401ks. So, and we're actually simples as well. So you can put an additional, you know, $1,000 into an IRA. You can put, you know, another $5,000 or $6,000 into your 401k, $6,000 in your 401k. So those are catch-up provision. 55. People that are 55, there's things like catch-up provisions on your health savings accounts. A lot of folks don't know that. Also, if you terminate service in the year you're 55 or after, you can take penalty-free withdrawals from retirement accounts. You have 59 and a half, penalty-free withdrawals from IRAs. 60, if you lost a spouse, age 60 is the age at which you become eligible to collect Social Security benefits. 62, you become eligible for Social Security, of course, a reduction, 25% permanent. 65, Medicare. 66, for most people listening, full retirement age for Social Security. And then 70 and a half, minimum distributions on retirement accounts. So a lot of that we'll talk about next week as well. But there you go. All right, let's talk about inherited accounts. I inherited an IRA from my dad a few years ago. Then my mom passed away, and I inherited an IRA from her. Can I just combine the two together or combine them with my own? So here's the thing. You can't. I mean, that's the short answer, but you can't. Each of these have to maintain the separate titling. So the inherited IRA you got from your dad, that is one. Mom's the other. You have to take minimum distributions from each of those based on your life expectancy. So when dad passed away, you know, that started. And then when mom passed away, it started. You have to keep those separate. And you certainly can't roll them into your own IRA. That's for sure. All right. Do I have to pay here's another one. Do I have to pay taxes on an inherited IRA when I take the money out? Will there be a penalty? What about if you inherit money from a spouse and it comes in the form of an IRA? So let's start with the first one. The answer is that if the person you inherited the IRA from had not paid taxes on that money, then you will pay taxes. Now, some folks have a basis in their IRA, and you need to know this because you'll end up paying taxes on money you shouldn't. But let's say that they had made after-tax contributions to a retirement account, which was really popular a long time ago, and they passed away, and $20,000 of the $100,000 is money they've already paid taxes on. So when you pull money out, you're going to pay taxes on 80% of it, but you need to know that. So that's how that works. But you will pay taxes on money they didn't pay taxes on. The other part of that question, will there be a penalty? No, inherited IRAs, there is no penalty. And then also, if you're someone who inherited it from your spouse, so when you have a spousal beneficiary, you can either make that your own or make it a beneficiary IRA. Why would you make it a beneficiary IRA versus just making it your own? If you're under 59 and a half and your spouse passed away, then make it an inherited IRA. That way, you can take penalty-free withdrawals. If you make it your own IRA, then you'd have to wait until you're 59 and a half before you take those withdrawals penalty-free. All right, here's another one. I heard Dave Ramsey say that paying for long-term care riders on life insurance shouldn't be done because they're too expensive. He also suggested getting long-term care insurance at 60. What are your thoughts on this matter? Well, I love Dave Ramsey. I've listened to him a lot. There's a few areas that we maybe don't see completely eye to eye on. But he also did go on to say, just so you know, that you should consult a local financial advisor on these topics. So here's the thing. Long-term care riders on life insurance policies, you either going to pay for them early or pay for them later. And this is the way it works. Some companies will charge extra premium for the long-term care rider that allows you to accelerate the death benefit early to pay for long-term care. Other policies don't charge anything up front, but if you use it, they won't accelerate 100% of your death benefits. So maybe you're 87 years old, they'll give you about 87% of your money. So they basically charge on the backside by keeping some of the death benefit. So, you know, things, when you hear stuff, it's not too good to be true generally. It's too good to be free, right? But it's just a matter of how you pay it. But I would disagree with Dave on this. I would say that if you have the right policy for you, I would suggest that you buy it. Now, suggesting long-term care at age 60, that's a great idea, because once you get over 60, it just goes up exponentially in price. It becomes very difficult to get. And traditional long-term care insurance is health insurance. So you qualify for it, you pay for it, it may go up over time. You know, I'm not a super, super big fan for most people of buying traditional long-term care insurance, just simply because of those factors. I mean, if you don't use it, you lose it. That's a big one for most people. I'd like these other kind of policies better. If I have a life insurance policy that's designed for long-term care, I'm going to die. There's a one-on-one chance of that, right? So someone's going to get the money. But if it's there, if I need it for long-term care, it's there too. So maybe a little bit of a disagreement there, but I wouldn't say we're off too much. Here's another one. I went to file my tax form for Social Security. Okay, so I went to apply for Social Security. I went to fill out my tax form to say whether or not I wanted withholdings on my Social Security tax. That's what, or Social Security check. That's what it's trying to say. But they didn't see any place for state tax to be withheld. Is that a separate form or something that I need to get for the state? That's the question. Okay, so the good news is in Indiana, Social Security is not taxed. So that's why there is no area for your state tax withholding. And even at the federal level, not 100% of it's going to be taxed. Up to 85% of your benefit is subject to tax. And that's why when you do check the boxes, it's like, you know, 15, 7, or something like that, and 2. I mean, there's 3 boxes you check, and they seem a little bit odd, but that's because of only 85% of it being subject to tax. Here's another tax question. My goodness. Do you pay taxes on disability income? So if you become disabled and you have a disability policy, let's say it's through work or you bought it on your own, are those benefits taxable? This actually came from one of the guys in the office. They had a client going through this. And the answer is, if you paid the premium with after-tax dollars, or you paid the premiums, then the benefit is not taxable to you. If the company paid for that policy, then it's taxable. And that's where it gets a little tough, because typically you'll receive 60% of your gross pay in the form of disability payments. Well, if the employer paid the premiums, and then that's taxable to you, 60% taxable, now I'm getting 40% of my gross before, and I'm probably not going to make it like I was before. So, you know, you need to know those types of things. All right, let's see. Any more questions here that we want to bring up? How do I get kids off? We'll save that one for next week. So we've got a lot going on next week, because, again, we have our Dealing with Dementia Town Hall meeting. We'd love for you to come. Go to cfci.us and click the seminar button on the right. Sign up for that. You have Lemonade Day coming up on May 21st. We encourage you to either sign up someone to build a stand. I've seen this happen where kids have done this for multiple years, and now they're thinking about other businesses that they'd like to do. And also, we want to continue to offer the definitive guide to required minimum distributions for baby boomers. It comes right out of my Ed Slot class. It's a long, long guide. We can email it. So every time we offer that on the radio, we always get several people that ask about it. But if you're not into reading 40 pages about required distributions and you'd rather have a quick reference guide, we also have Calculate Your Required Minimum Distributions as Easy as 1, 2, 3, and it gives you 3 easy steps on how to calculate minimum distributions from retirement accounts. So, hey, we're going to take a break. We'll come back, wrap up the big show. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. We're wrapping up the big show. Like I mentioned, next week I will be on the road in Atlanta. You know, here's what's funny. My son, now 15 years old, and we've been having a ball this spring, getting out in the early morning to, you know, turkey hunt. We've been fishing a lot. You know, he's been golfing on the golf team. It's been a lot of fun. But I used to travel like this. I mean, I always have in the springtime and conferences and different things like that. But the awareness now he now has. He said to me, "Man, you're traveling a lot now. You're gone a lot." And I said, "You know what? Just because you're 15, you're noticing it. Back when you were like 6 or 7 years old, you could care less if I was gone or not, as long as Mama was there to take care of you." So I will be gone next week for the Ed Slott Elite IRA Advisor meeting down in Hotlanta. But don't despair. Doug Hughes will be here live, and then I'll call in. It'll be a good show. We're going to be talking about a lot of the IRA distribution strategies that we talk about, learn about while we're in the Ed Slott meeting. And again, happy graduation to all of those that have stuck it out over the time period at Indiana University. It's not easy, and you're entering a world that you're on your own when it comes to this stuff, money. I mean, you really are. You're not going to have pensions like your parents or grandparents had. You're going to take Social Security later in life. You're going to be paying more for Social Security because they're going to be raising the taxable wage basis on you guys. And you just got to start off early. Start off right. You know, if you have student loan debt, manage through that. Don't focus on that and not focus on the other one. If you have a company match, jump in there and grab that thing. It's free money. And start off early because out of sight, out of mind. I mean, if you never have it in your pocket, you won't spend it. And you're broke now, right? So just continue to act like you're broke, and you will then accumulate dollars. You'll get raises. You'll move on, and that's the way this goes. So happy graduation to all of you out there. We really, really are encouraging you to go out and make a difference in the world. Hey, I haven't really talked about our book a whole lot lately, but we're still really encouraging people to get out to Amazon and purchase Today's Guide to Retirement Planning. We'd love to put it in everybody's pocket. We've been giving out a lot of them, you know, here on the show. In fact, you know what? For this show, let's do it again. Today's Guide to Retirement Planning, I'll give away 10 free books. So if you want to email us at cfci.us and just say, "I'd like the book," we'll get it to you. We'll get it to you. A hard copy. Actually, I say a hard copy. There are no hard copies. It's a soft copy, but it won't be an e-copy. It'll be a real live $16.95 valuable edition of Today's Guide to Retirement Planning. So, hey, I hope everyone has a terrific weekend. Happy Mother's Day. My wife, Misty, my mom, Rhea, my stepmother, Jeannie. Happy Mother's Day. I love you guys very much. And we'll see all of you or talk to you all next week. Goodbye. The preceding program was brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities.